Modern Love, the podcast, is supported by...
This podcast is supported by Cartier. In celebration of the Trinity Collection's 100th anniversary, Cartier shares testaments of love in all its forms from around the world. Please keep listening for today's love story later in this episode.
Produced by the iLab at WBUR, Boston.
From the New York Times and WBUR Boston, this is Modern Love. Stories of love, loss, and redemption. I'm your host, Meghna Chakrabarty. Modern Love will be back with brand new episodes in 2 weeks, but today we're bringing you some of our favorite past episodes. We've put together a playlist featuring three stories about the secrets that can define a relationship, starting with an essay by Amelia Blanquera about a secret her father tried to keep. Danielle Brooks is best known as Tasty on the Netflix series Orange is the New Black, which recently released its sixth season on Netflix. She reads Amelia's essay about that rustle in the bushes.
When my sister, Ardell, first told me about the binder, I could feel my body tense. A younger version of me would have immediately dialed my father and confronted him, because who would believe that my 77-year-old father Google stalks my boyfriends and keeps a binder of his salvaged details and opinions for reference? But years of therapy taught me to wait 10 seconds before automatically exploding with anger. So, in this case, I was able to keep cool long enough to decide to bring it up later with him in person. If you were to look up the term helicopter parenting in the Wikipedia of my life, you would see a picture of my parents. They would be the ones in the Huey, the ominous military chopper used in the Vietnam War. Noisy and clunky, my parents made their presence known. In my childhood house, they read mail addressed to my siblings and me, rummaged through drawers and opened doors without knocking. It was the norm for them to be invasive, and their lack of respect for privacy annoyed me. Although my siblings weren't as forthcoming with my parents about their lives, I always told them the truth. It took me a while to figure out that they didn't want a true retelling of events, but the one that fit the fiction of how they thought my life should be. My parents were more attuned to the upbeat experiences. The rough patches were harder for them to process. Not long after I learned about the binder, my father asked about the man I was then dating. A newscaster. I decided to play it cool to see if he would come clean about it. That guy was all over the media. My father didn't need to look very hard to find him. Later, when visiting my parents for the holidays, my father asked, "Did you know he used to be married?" "I used to be married too," I said. "Yes. But you have no idea why he got divorced," my father tried to prod me for more information. But the newscaster had told me what I needed to know, and that was good enough for me. "By the way," I asked, moving closer to where he was sitting at his desk, "how do you know he was divorced?" "It's all on the internet," he said innocently, smiling as if to diffuse the mounting tension. Our dynamic has always been tumultuous. We argue a lot. Men in the past have told me I have a tone that's sarcastic and mocking, a tone that broadcasts to the receiver, "I think you're an idiot." My mother doesn't have this voice. I must mimic my father. "I know about the binder, Dad," I finally said. "Ardell told me. Show it to me." "What? I don't know what you're talking about," he said. "Ardell told me that you have a binder with information on the people I've dated." He squirmed, but offered no confession. Did he believe he wasn't doing anything wrong? I was calling his bluff. "Do I need to ask Mom?" I said. To their credit, my parents act as a unit. Even if one of them has a wacky idea, they always back each other up. "Mom, can you show me the binder?" I shouted into the other room. "Did you ask your father?" she shouted back. "I don't know what you're talking about." It was obvious she knew. She's a terrible liar. I looked at my father. He smirked a bit and then blurted out, "How am I going to protect you?" Although he is physically agile and mentally acute for a senior citizen, he is not in any shape to be a vigilante on my behalf. His worldview, too, is a bit skewed. He delights in news stories about corruption, scandals, and suspicious activities. Something about doomsday movies placates him, whereas my mother used to take my siblings and me to see the latest Disney film, my father sat with us in front of the television to watch Soylent Green and Blade Runner, among others. If the apocalypse came, he wanted us to be ready. With my father's mentoring, I understood that the world wasn't cuddly and charming, but dark and sinister. It wasn't that my father was trying to frighten or upset my siblings and me. Rather, I think he was showing us through the movies never to accept life at face value. As an adult, I chose sunny and sweet. It just seemed less anxiety-provoking that way. I eyeballed the room to see if my father had the audacity to keep my dating binder on the shelf with his other records. He kept files on all his doctors. Each 2-inch plastic binder was labeled with the physician's name written on surgical tape with a black Sharpie marker. Other than details about my father's specific ailments, each doctor's binder contained a printout of whatever personal and professional information my father could assemble. If nothing else, he was a meticulous record keeper, but he wouldn't give up my binder. "So you're not going to let me see it?" I asked. "I don't know what you're talking about. If my father hadn't become an engineer, he would have made a great spy." He tried to contain his obsessive worry after I left for college, but every so often he would show up, and there it would be again. Like the time he visited my Brooklyn apartment and insisted on buying me electrical outlet covers as if I were still an infant who might stick a fork into the socket. His concerns abated when I was married because there was another person to worry about me. But his protective instincts came back in triple strength after I was divorced. In the moment, here's what I knew. He had a binder. My mother denied it. My sister had seen it, yet my father wouldn't confess because he knew his actions were overstepping my boundaries. Did he really think I couldn't take care of myself? That offended me. In years past, his constant second-guessing had escalated into blowouts. Our shouting matches had made us both feel terrible afterward. So this time around, I wasn't going to let it reach that level. I knew I could take care of myself. Even if some of my previous relationships hadn't worked out, I still trusted my judgment. I was willing to take on the risk. My father just needed to tell me the truth about the binder. "Well, if you're going to keep a file on him," I said, "at least let me help you pick out the articles." My father turned on his computer, and we scrolled through various articles written by the newscaster. Not a Google stalker myself. I had never seen what came up. His writing was informative and smart. The video clip showed his sense of humor. There definitely was enough material for a private investigator to find this guy. He was hiding in plain sight. At this point, I thought my father would crack, but he stubbornly held his ground. Obviously, this was his attempt to reinsert some control into my world, even if he wasn't around to witness it. I thought I could handle a small bit of intrusion. We just needed to negotiate an understanding. You can research the men I'm dating, I offered, but I don't want you to tell me what you find unless the guy has a criminal record. I'd like to know that, but nothing else. Okay, he said, turning back to his computer. He was doing his best to hide his anxiety, but all the sighing and loud typing betrayed him. His fears were something he would need to learn to manage for himself. And then I felt something I hadn't before regarding his overbearing ways. Tenderness. It felt oddly comforting to know that my father has my back in his paranoid way. Since I don't have children, I asked my brother Arturo what he thought. As the parent of two pre-teenage daughters, would he behave in the same way? I think my need to control their lives will diminish as they age, he said. But it might gain in resurgence as I age. Then he offered this sanguine observation. At least he's trying to stay in touch and be involved, albeit in a covert manner. True. So, I've decided not to fight it anymore. But I intend to warn any love interest not to post anything on my Facebook wall because my personal, private investigator is only a click away, and anything suspicious is likely to go on his permanent record.
Danielle Brooks, reading Amelia Blanquera's essay, About That Rustle in the Bushes. This is usually when we hear from the author who wrote the story you just heard, but we're very sad to say that Amelia Blanquera died unexpectedly in March of 2017 due to complications from hypertension. She was just 47 years old. Her father, Arturo, and sister, Ardell, agreed to tell us more about Amelia, and they were thrilled to hear that her modern love piece was being shared on the podcast.
I think she would have been really excited and really pleased that her work was being valued.
That's Ardell, who told us that writing was actually Amelia's third career. She worked in publishing and then spent 12 years as a lawyer before enrolling in Columbia's MFA nonfiction program.
Writing was so fulfilling to her, and she was just a very generous student and a very just generous human being, and was very thoughtful in the classroom.
Amelia also taught workshops and led student writing groups at Columbia and NYU.
And all of her students have been able to send us condolences on what a sharing spirit she had, and she created this atmosphere within the classroom that enabled people to feel vulnerable and to feel safe in sharing their writing.
Amelia knew this vulnerability well. Her modern love piece was one of many personal essays she had published. She didn't show the essay to her father before exposing his Google stalking ways to millions of readers, but Arturo didn't deny a word of it.
I know more than she knows about her dates because I Googled them where they went to school. I'm really a protective father, see?
Arturo is 84 years old and lives in Florida with Amelia's mother, Floridalis. He no longer has Amelia's binder, but he does still have the ones he created on his son's wives.
Yeah. But they don't know it. They don't know it.
Well, now they do, Dad.
Now they don't.
Dad, don't you think it's a little bit crazy to actually create like a dossier on every single person that your children has ever dated or had a romantic interest in?
Well, I'm just checking out if they are okay, you see. If you are in love, you use your heart, but you don't use your mind, see. So I have to be behind you. I have to be like a backup, see.
Thanks, Dad.
You just make your decision, that's all.
Amelia did the deciding for herself in her own life, from romance to career to travel. She spent time in Brazil, Spain, and the Philippines, where her family is from. In Brooklyn, she became deeply involved in her community garden and in the Brooklyn Queens Land Trust. She used her law degree to create a sustainable legal structure for the organization.
And that sort of combination of her love of gardening and her legal background and the writing was culminating in a proposal for a book that she had had a working title of Citizen Gardener. And it was about the fight to save New York City's community gardens from development.
Citizen Gardener was Amelia's thesis project at Columbia. Ardell accepted Amelia's MFA on her behalf last month, and she's working with Amelia's professors to find a way to finish the project. Arturo told us that Amelia's wide network of students, classmates, and gardeners has made the impact of her loss even greater.
Amelia will be remembered by so many people. She's happy, contributing, and helping others. And I learned a lot from her. You must give back to other people too. That's what she said. Because that will make you happy.
I miss her laugh. I miss her advice. I miss her wit. And I keep wanting to continue on her work and her spirit.
I'm very grateful to have her as my daughter and me and my wife. We love her and we miss her so much.
Arturo Blanquera, father of Amelia Blanquera. We also heard from Amelia's sister, Ardell Jala. You can see pictures of Amelia and her family on our website, wbur.org/modernlove. As editor of the Modern Love column for the New York Times, Daniel Jones gets to know these stories inside out. But news of Amelia's sudden passing gave him a different perspective on her essay.
It's tempting to look at an essay that's taken from a life as this complete piece, but they aren't complete pieces, and the lives go on and things change. And this is a piece that just takes on a whole new meaning and a whole new resonance and just a tragic level of how protective love can really only go so far. You know, you can't. It's just such a parent's nightmare to think you've launched your children out into the world and you have to let go of them and you think, oh, they're going to be okay. Everybody's going to be okay. That's just the way that it works out. And it really just hollows you out to think of this story in that context of a father who cared so deeply and tried so hard, you know, to have it end this way. It really, really affects you.
More stories about secrets after the break.
Hi, this is Eric Kim with New York Times Cooking. As a recipe developer, I spend a lot of my time trying to come up with dishes that are quick, easy, but also very special. For me, that means dishes like gochugaru salmon. It's a crispy salmon fillet with a salty, sweet glaze that bubbles up and candies. I love cooking this because it only takes 20 minutes. You can get this recipe and so many more ideas on New York Times Cooking. Visit nytcooking.com to get inspired.
Do parents and children ever stop getting to know one another? Mary Alice Hostetter puts all of her assumptions to the test. Tony Award winner Cynthia Nixon reads Mary Alice's essay, Dear Dad, We've Been Gay for a Really Long Time.
The first letter was not mine. Although my brother Charles and I had spent so much time talking about it that I felt some ownership. I was in San Francisco for the Thanksgiving holiday, and we had read and reread the letter he was planning to send to my father, changing a word here and there, rearranging sentences. I suggested he replace gay with homosexual, the word my father was more likely to have heard, usually in the same sentence with abomination, from the pulpit of the Mennonite church he and my mother had attended for decades. I was supportive of my brother, respected his courage, and was flattered that he valued my opinion about something so important, but I didn't fully understand. "You really think he needs to know?" I asked. "How is this going to help him?" "It's not for him," Charles said. "I'm doing this for me. I'm over 60 years old, and he still thinks I'll get married if I find the right woman." "It's not like he's rejected you," I said. "He thinks the sun rises and sets on his doctor sons." "I don't know what he'll do with this, but I need him to know who I am." I told my partner later, "Charles is obsessed with that letter." "Seems like it's important to him for your father to know," she said. "I think our father's doing the best he can," I said. "He never went beyond eighth grade, and he's been a farmer his whole life. His world's pretty narrow. He's 95. Something like this? No telling how he'll take it." "You may as well let it go," she said. The next morning, my brother asked if I wanted to walk with him to the mailbox. The sun was glistening off the buildings on the San Francisco skyline against a brilliant blue sky. We walked to Fillmore, and I watched him drop the letter into the mailbox slot. "There it goes," he said. "No taking it back now," I said. We took the long way home, through Alamo Square Park, the iconic painted ladies lined up in the morning light. "I wonder who'll visit first after he gets the letter," my brother said. "Who'll get to process it with him?" Two of our eight brothers lived near his nursing home in Pennsylvania and checked in on him every week. "I know Abe goes every Wednesday afternoon," I said, "and I think Ike goes on Friday." "Abe is a psychiatrist. Ike, a retired farmer and Mennonite deacon. There are 12 of us siblings altogether." "Doubt it'll get there by Wednesday," my brother said. My partner and I flew back to Virginia, and the busyness of catching up at work and preparing for the holidays distracted me from wondering when the news would hit the family grapevine. It didn't take long before the reports started trickling in. Each tidbit so remarkable, I began to keep a record so I wouldn't forget. Ike, the farmer brother, was the first one my father showed the letter to. "Did you know this?" my father asked. "Everyone pretty much knows it." "I sure didn't," my father said. "Had no idea." By the following Wednesday, when Abe visited, my father had more questions. "How does this happen?" Abe said, "Seems some people are just born that way." "Are a lot of them born that way?" "About 1 in 10, they estimate." "Well, if it's how people are born, it sure doesn't seem like something that should tear families apart." That proclamation rippled up and down the family grapevine, and it seemed it should echo down the halls of Fairmont Nursing Home, past the nurses' stations, and across the fields to the plain brick Mennonite churches. After my father received and processed my brother's letter, he seemed to spend a good deal of time in his sunny room contemplating this new reality. It was clear he gave some thought to the 1 in 10 theory, and from his vantage point overlooking the nursing home entrance, he counted off visitors, wondering. He talked to visiting family members about unmarried relatives, neighbors. When my younger brother Sanford visited, my father said, "You know, I've been thinking about Eli." Eli was an Amish neighbor. All those years, he worked that farm by himself. I remember when he was younger, he dated girls, but it didn't work out for him. I wonder if that was the story with Eli. Makes me feel bad that he never found someone. And then the question started about me. "It makes me wonder about Mary Alice," my father said. "What about her?" "I guess you should ask her," Sanford said. Of course, my father wasn't going to. It wasn't the sort of thing we would talk about. When Sanford told me about the conversation, I knew it was time to clear things up, to let my father know that I was part of the 1 in 10. I could have dispatched a sibling to deliver my news. I could have shouted it to my hearing-impaired father over the phone or on my next visit. A letter seemed like the most reliable way to communicate. After my brother's courageous letter, I knew mine would be anticlimactic, not only because my brothers came first, but also because I was one of 4 daughters, and in our family, especially from my father's point of view, nothing about being a daughter appeared to have the same import as it would have from a son. So I wrote my letter and sent it. But during my next visit, the subject never came up. My father was as welcoming to my partner and me as he always had been. I considered asking him about the letter, but never did. Had my mother still been alive, I think the conversation would have been outsourced to her. They had lived at the nursing home together for a couple of years before she died at 95. Just a few weeks after they celebrated their 74th anniversary. For years after she died, my father glanced toward her chair when he needed to tell her something, and I'm sure he would have liked to know what she thought of the letters. I can only hope she would have been as understanding as my father was. But I'll never know. The nursing home where my parents lived was run by conservative Mennonites and was consistently recognized for the quality of its care and its cleanliness. Many of the staff members considered their work a religious calling. A steady stream of volunteers cleaned the residents' eyeglasses, shined their shoes, massaged feet, and filled the halls and chapels with music. My father ate his meals in the main dining hall, but insisted on a full-size refrigerator in his room to store his Turkey Hill black cherry ice cream, which my brothers made sure he always had. He kept the bowls and spoons in the refrigerator, along with pretzels and pink mints for the children. He served himself a snack each evening. As one of only a handful of men in the nursing home, my father was much sought after by the widows. He made it clear that he had no intention of remarrying, but he did invite some of them over for a bowl of ice cream now and then. His vision of heaven included reuniting with our mother. Although he was longing for that time, he first wanted to live to be 100, or at the very least, live longer than his older brother, who had died just short of 99. In time, my father's focus on who was or wasn't gay abated. The reality blended into the landscape of carefully tended farms, stretching as far as he could see from his nursing home window. Sometimes I like to imagine him sitting in the sunroom with the 3 other men in his wing, all of them hard of hearing, him shouting, "And I have 2 children who are gay. What do you make of that?" My father died 10 years ago, a week short of his 100th birthday. I think it gave him peace knowing all 12 of his children had found someone with whom to share their lives. If he's with my mother in heaven, I hope he has brought her up to date on family news. If he's run into Eli up there, his Amish neighbor, I expect he's told him how sorry he is that he had to work the farm by himself all those years. Recently, many of the Mennonite churches in Lancaster County, Pennsylvania, decided to split from Mennonite Church USA, which has chosen to allow openly gay members. The only thing as important as church to my parents was family. I'm glad they didn't live to see this time. Would church or family win? Would my father speak up against his church to tell people, it's not the sort of thing to tear families apart? Last May, after 18 years together, my longtime partner and I married. I don't know what my parents would have made of that. But I wish they could have been there.
Cynthia Nixon, reading Mary Alice Hostetter's essay, Dear Dad, We've Been Gay for a Really Long Time. Mary Alice Hostetter lives in Charlottesville, Virginia, with her wife, Terry. She says she never realized how important it was to come out to her father until she did. And while the letter never came up in conversations, she assumes he read it because he never again asked her siblings about why she wasn't married. Just recently, she was cleaning out some files on her computer and ran across the letter. She read some of it to us.
I have a great deal of respect for Charles and his courage to be honest with you. I also have a great deal of respect for the way in which you have responded to that honesty. If all parents were as understanding as you, it would make the world a better place for people like us, who so many want to judge and persecute. I appreciate the example you have given us in accepting people for who they are and in honoring family, no matter what our differences might be.
Mary Alice says her father was a simple man, a farmer. He was also deeply religious.
I think his response came from a place of sort of very simple, basic, practical thinking. If someone says, that's how you're born, then it doesn't make sense to make a deal out of it. It's just who you are. So I think sometimes there's a great deal of wisdom in that level of simplicity, and that is where his response came from.
She says the bulk of the responses to her essay were positive, and she's thankful for that. But it was the act of publishing these words that made this a transformative experience.
When I saw the article in the Times, the essay, of course, I had moments of disbelief. There would have been a time in my life that nothing would have been more unlikely than that level of honesty, even among people I know fairly well. So seeing it there in the New York Times was just remarkable and made me feel so, I don't want to say powerful, but something like powerful.
Mary Alice Hostetter. She lives in Charlottesville, Virginia, and is currently writing a memoir about her life growing up in a Mennonite community. Dan Jones is the editor of Modern Love for the New York Times. He says over the past 13 years, submissions to the column have mirrored societal change.
How coming out, when this column started, how coming out as gay, just for the average person, could still be a story, then it quickly became not a story. But there's sort of this delayed effect depending on the community you're in. And typically, and this is a good example in Mary Alice's story, the people are much older. You know, they've been together for decades in some cases. So this is a case where coming out, you know, in 2016, when this piece ran, is still a story in certain communities, and a very moving one. And it made this idea of social change, like it really just makes you think that it's dominoes being knocked over until the very last one is knocked over. Like it's not something that goes to a certain point and then stops.
Dan manages the Modern Love Facebook page, so keep up with his musings throughout the week by checking out facebook.com/modernlove. Cynthia Nixon says the stoicism of the father in this piece appealed to her.
My mother's mother's family is from Missouri, and I always remember when my mother started seeing a man that she was eventually with for almost 35 years who was Jewish, when she talked to her great aunt, who was like a second mother to her, she was curious to know whether my great aunt would have any negative reaction to that. And my great aunt Edna sort of scrunched up her face and said, "Oh, there's so much more important things than that kind of thing to worry about." And that my great aunt's attitude and her proclamation to me echoed the patriarch's sentiment. And I think there is running through Middle America that kind of people making up their mind and not making a fuss and having what we would consider a degree of enlightenment, but it's just sort of practical common sense, too. Why would we worry about such a thing?
Thanks again to Cynthia Nixon. She's currently running for governor of New York. After the break, Uma Thurman.
Hi, this is Eric Kim with New York Times Cooking. As a recipe developer, I spend a lot of my time trying to come up with dishes that are quick, easy, but also very special. For me, that means dishes like gochugaru salmon. It's a crispy salmon fillet with a salty, sweet glaze that bubbles up and candies. I love cooking this because it only takes 20 minutes. You can get this recipe and so many more ideas on New York Times Cooking. Visit nytcooking.com to get inspired.
I found the driver's name from a police report that had been filed in Florida 17 years before. The report was torn and creased and incorrect. It said, a boy was crossing the street on his bicycle, but there had been two boys in the road that day and no bike. It said, the boy was hit and his body was thrown 19 yards. But he wasn't thrown. He was dragged that far, caught in the dangling chains of the landscaping trailer hitched to the truck. It said someone fled the scene, but that someone was my older brother, Alex, and he didn't flee. He dropped the bucket of fish he and Jonathan had caught and rushed over to his friend, but the boy was already dead. Alex had just turned 15. This is the day we never spoke about.
Uma Thurman, reading an essay by Jessica Sensen Henriquez. It's called The Accident No One Talked About.
We were born 1 year and 3 months apart, but looked like twins with our rosebud lips and Irish blue eyes. Before the accident, we were inseparable. We had our own rooms, but often shared my bed when we were little. When we got too big for that, Alex started sleeping on my bedroom floor. In the dark, we joke about all of the things we could buy if someday we won the lottery. A house made of pizza for him, and an island full of monkeys for me. Alex told me ghost stories until I was too scared to fall asleep. He would reach up from the floor to hold my hand, letting go somewhere between midnight and morning. After the accident, Alex never slept in my room again. On the way to the funeral, Our parents told him that what had happened was God's will, that this was part of a much bigger plan. On the way home, as Alex slept, they told me that maybe it was better if we didn't bring it up again. So when I heard Alex crying in his room at night, I stayed where I was, wrapped in my comforter, and I didn't bring it up. When Alex was 19, he dropped out of college, even though he had always been the smart one, the honor roll son, and I didn't bring it up. At 23, when he was first arrested on charges of driving under the influence, and at 24, when he went to jail for reckless driving, and at 25, 26, and 27, when he was getting high in the morning and drunk at night, I never brought it up. Instead, my parents posted his bail, I paid off his credit cards, and if he needed a ride or rent money, one of us came through. When none of that worked to change him, I took a different tack. I started yelling at him to grow up, take responsibility, stop drinking, start working, and go back to school. Then I would soften and say how much I loved him and how proud of him I was when he got a job waiting tables. And yes, I would help pay for culinary school, and yes, he and his new girlfriend could stay with me whenever they visited New York City, and no, there was nothing I wanted more than to see him happy again. When none of that worked, I still didn't bring it up. Until one night, when we were 30 and 31, and I offhandedly and uncomfortably asked over dinner if he ever thought about the day Jonathan died. "Oh, now you want to talk about that," he shot back with a laugh. And in that moment, I felt his fury over our silence. "You don't need to worry about it now." We had been communicating before we could even speak, but this conversation we didn't have words for. "Do you remember," I asked him, "when you were 7 and you got that awful haircut and then I begged Mom for a matching mullet?" He smiled but said nothing. "And how much you liked swing dancing when we were kids, so I let you practice all those dips and throws on me, even though I knew I would end up on the ground?" "I did that for you," he said. "You liked swing, not me." The point I wanted to make, but didn't know how, was that I missed sharing a life with him. Later, we both went home and let the silence continue to grow. I was desperate to reconnect and convinced that the only way to do so was to get as close as I could to the moment when his life split into a before and an after. I needed to talk to someone who knew what Alex knew, who had seen what Alex had seen. I searched the online archives of our hometown newspaper and scrolled for hours until I found Jonathan's name in a write-up about the accident. After a dozen phone calls, I tracked down the police report. They couldn't mail me a copy, but said I was welcome to come to the station and see it for myself. So not long after, I flew to Florida and did just that. Sitting on a swivel chair in the police station's cramped archives office, I ran my finger over my brother's sloppy teenage script, his signature underneath his witness statement. As I read, I could almost hear his voice. Traffic was speeding up. There wasn't enough time. I reached the sidewalk first, and when I turned around, Jonathan was still in the middle of the road. I saw him get hit. When the ambulance came, I had to go across the street and tell his mother. I wrote down the driver's name and later found his phone number listed online. By the time I was back in New York, I had thought of 100 reasons not to call, but I had to. He knew what Alex had been through. On the 6th ring, he picked up. "Yeah? Hello?" "Please don't hang up," I said. I told him my name and explained that I wanted to know about an accident he was involved in back in 1999. Two boys were crossing the street, and I was the sister of the boy who lived. "That choice was the hardest I ever made in my life," he said. He told me that by the time he saw both boys in the road, he was already too close. If he swerved onto the sidewalk, he would hit Alex. If he didn't, he would hit Jonathan. "All I know is there were two boys in front of me," he said. "I had to decide in that very moment, and it was so fast. I chose not to hit your brother that day." What kind of choice is that? I pinched the place between my forefinger and thumb, a trick I'd picked up in college to keep from crying. I said there were questions I wanted to ask, but it was all right if he didn't remember every detail. It was a long time ago. "Not for me," he said. For 3 hours, he spoke about his pain, his frustrations with his family when they didn't understand, about his lost jobs and addictions, about how he never married or had children. Talking to him felt like the closest I could come to holding Alex's hand again. I told him I wanted to find a way to take away my brother's pain. "You can't," he said. "But if you want to lessen it, you've got to listen." "What if he won't talk to me?" "Ask again," he said. "He'll come round, and once those words start coming, you'll realize that asking was the easy part. Listening is the hard part, and that's what you have to do." I hung up the phone, but didn't stop there. I tracked down the witnesses who testified in court, the on-scene paramedic, the emergency room doctor, and the nurse who sat with Jonathan's mother at the hospital. And the more I heard, the more Alex's story became defanged. 1 year after that first phone call, I met with my brother and told him about the people I had spoken to and what they had said. And his instinct was to confirm and correct each detail. That was my opening. And his. Later, I was able to ask what no one in our family ever had. "Could you just start at the beginning and tell me everything?" And he did. When I see Alex today at 33, I no longer see someone who is stuck in one memory. I see a father to two beautiful little boys and a committed partner to the woman he will one day marry. I see a man who works harder than anyone I know, waking up to go to the restaurant on holidays and weekends, because he no longer needs or wants the kind of help I offered before I learned that asking and listening are the most valuable of all.
That's Uma Thurman reading The Accident No One Talked About by Jessica Sensen Henriquez. Jessica says that she still feels guilt and shame about the silence that grew around this incident for so long.
I felt ashamed that I wasn't strong enough to stand up and say, what's wrong? Can I help? I'm here. I care. You know, those words are so powerful. And as a young girl, I didn't understand quite yet the power that they had. And so to sit there night after night and listen to him cry and know that he was suffering and feel so hopeless, I think I feel a little bit, still a little bit of shame about that period. But, you know, at the same time, I am very forgiving to my younger self. And that's taken a lot of time to learn.
She remains profoundly moved by her conversation with the driver who hit Jonathan. And she says that when they spoke, she didn't anticipate that the driver would open up to her like he did, or that his experience would sound so much like her brother's.
There was so much similarity. There was addiction. There was losing jobs. There was relationships that didn't work out. There was alcoholism. There was, you know, just this pain that rippled through the driver's life that I saw rippling through my brother's life. And listening to the driver tell his story, it was just so emotional for me because I was listening to it as though it was my brother speaking.
But a few days after that conversation, Jessica got a call from the driver's sister.
She was very angry because her brother had come to her in so much pain telling her about this phone call and what had happened, and it just stirred all of these things back up for him. And in that moment, when she was letting me know what she thought of me, all I saw was that she was a woman who was a sister, and she was doing or attempting to do exactly what I had done. She was trying to protect her brother, and she was trying to take away all of his pain. And so at the end of that phone call, she said, "Do not contact him again." And I had to say, "You're right." And then I let them both know. I assured them that I would step back.
Jessica and Jonathan's mothers are still friends. And Jessica says she thought deeply about the impact that telling this story might have on their family.
I really battled with the idea of how much should people have to relive? You know, just writing the opening scene, I was only thinking of her. If she ever reads this, will this be more painful for her to read than it has to be? I'm not sure how the family responded. They've not reached out to me. I've not heard a response from them. But I'm okay with the idea of somebody being silent and that not necessarily being a negative thing.
And how is Alex doing now?
Alex is beautiful. He is my favorite person in this world. And he has two little boys. And he's such a good father. And he's such a good brother. And he's just a good man. And I know that that has not come easily for him. And I am completely aware of the fact that he will always have to try harder than other people to be okay.
Jessica also knows that nearly two decades later, Alex is burdened by what happened that day.
When it comes to trauma, there is no end. It is part of you, and it doesn't go away. Even when it's faced, it doesn't disappear. That experience still exists in him. And I think the idea of removing it or trying to get to the point where you're quote-unquote over it, that is a really impossible aim.
Jessica says that the accident and her family's response to it has helped shape the way she's raising her own son. And she's learned one overarching lesson.
If you love someone, you have to ask what's wrong. And when they say nothing, nothing's wrong, you have to ask again. And if for whatever reason you stop asking, that conversation will never happen. And those conversations, this conversation in this story, it has the power to heal. It doesn't have the power to change history. It doesn't have the power to take away what has already happened. It has the power to heal moving forward.
That's Jessica Sensen-Henriquez. She's a writer living in New York City and working on her first memoir. Here's Uma Thurman.
I feel that this is a beautiful essay about healing and about love. And I think this writer, she has an enormous courage and obviously a very deep love for her brother. And I think this is a story about how you can continue to heal throughout your life in enormously significant ways with an open heart.
Thanks again to Uma Thurman for reading this week's essay. Dan Jones says he published this essay because it explores the consequences of ignoring trauma.
In a way, it's a vindication of it's like never too late to talk about these sort of long-buried pains from childhood. And it's a real lesson in, as difficult as those conversations are, and as much as you don't want to have them, and as much as you want to think you're fine and just move on, how important those conversations are, and how important asking questions of a kid who's sort of traumatized and may not want to answer the questions, but you got to keep asking. You got to give them a chance to talk through all that difficult material.
Modern Love is a production of The New York Times and WBUR, Boston's NPR station. It's produced, directed, and edited by Jessica Alpert, Caitlin O'Keefe, and John Parati. Sound design and original scoring by Matt Reed. Our intern is Louisa Judge. The idea for the Modern Love podcast was conceived by Lisa Tobin. Iris Adler is our executive producer. Daniel Jones is the editor of Modern Love for The New York Times and advisor to the show. Music for the podcast, courtesy of APM. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We'll see you next week.